UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said this morning that it was possible Iraq could have been disarmed peacefully had diplomacy gone on longer. How does starting this war without the support of the Security Council affect the strength and authority of the UN? My guest, Philip Gurevich, recently wrote about the Security Council and Kofi Annan in The New Yorker. He's a staff writer for the magazine. He's also the author of a book about the genocide in Rwanda. I asked him first what events he thinks have defined the UN in the post-Cold War era.
Post-Cold War era story of the United Nations is that with the collapse of the Soviet Empire, and therefore with the sort of collapse of the paralyzing rivalry on the Security Council, suddenly the UN went through a brief period in the late 80s and early 90s of a sense of can-do euphoria and a real, almost hubristic at times, notion that it could do anything, that it could finally fulfill its mission. And suddenly you saw the negotiation through the UN of the ceasefire in the Iran-Iraq war and the demobilization there. The UN oversaw the withdrawal of Soviet forces from Afghanistan. It started to oversee elections and peace processes in Namibia, Cambodia, El Salvador, Mozambique. These were huge, long, ongoing, often wars that had had a strong element of being Cold War proxy wars. Suddenly these wars were being resolved. The UN was in there with these gigantic missions, things that they'd never done before. They were hiring in a hurry. They were deploying all over. And then you had the invasion of Kuwait by Saddam Hussein in 1990, and the Security Council agreed, wait, this is exactly the sort of thing that the United Nations was designed to deal with. The United Nations, to the extent that it's charged with this phrase, international peace and security, that's exactly what it means, between nations, international. You do not allow one sovereign country to have its sovereignty violated by another. So the idea was, we've got to get together and repel this act of naked aggression. And that was the Gulf War. And when, although nobody really relished the idea of seeing a massive armada of fighting equipment go forth under a UN flag, there was a feeling at the UN that here we finally are able to do the sort of thing that we were meant to do. This is a war under a vast international coalition. It's a kind of, it's not really a war, it's a police action.
So how did the story change after the Gulf War in 91?
The story changed after the Gulf War in 1991 when suddenly, instead of dealing with the aggression of one nation against another, you started to see the UN getting entangled in Bosnia, in Rwanda, and this was all particularly after Somalia. In Somalia, the killing of UN peacekeepers first, Pakistani peacekeepers, and then subsequently the famous Black Hawk Down killing of the 18 American Rangers led to a complete shift in the way that all of this was done. And mostly it led to a shift because the Clinton administration simply lost all of its stomach for peacekeeping and even for any kind of military action abroad. And so the chilling effect of Somalia on the ambitions of the United States to use the UN as a tool for peacekeeping in the post-Cold War world, and the ambitions of the UN itself to serve as kind of the world's intermediary force and the peacemakers, you cannot overstate how in one day in Somalia, with the deaths of those 18 Americans, an entire shift in the world order took place. And then you saw Bosnia, and then you saw Rwanda, where in fact the UN had a presence and was unable, not only unable to muster the will to stop the slaughter, but in many cases seemed like almost a tacitly complicit force in the slaughter when it stood by and watched in Srebrenica during the massacre in Srebrenica, the largest massacre since the Holocaust in Europe, where UN peacekeepers basically handed over the town to this Bosnian Serb forces who then killed more than 7,000 people, mostly men and boys. In Rwanda, you had 800,000 people killed in 100 days while a UN peacekeeping force was systematically reduced and withdrawn. These were enormously damaging to the United Nations system. The reason for them, of course, was to some extent that there wasn't will on the Security Council, and to a large extent that lack of will was America's lack of will, the Clinton administration's. But it also reflected a kind of larger functional incapacity of the UN as a bureaucracy and as an international bureaucracy, a bureaucracy that works by committee, that works by consensus, that doesn't have the efficiency and alacrity of the decision-making of a single government, and also lacks, crucially, Terry, the accountability. One thing that one saw in the mid-90s was when America was serious, it went and did things on its own. And so did other great powers and other major countries. But when you wanted to avoid dealing with a problem, but you wanted to make a gesture of concern, you went to the UN, you went to the Security Council, you deployed a few peacekeepers who were unarmed and incapable of dealing with the situation. And the disgrace then seemed to fall to the UN. It was a way of ducking your own accountability. And nobody at the UN has ever been punished for failing to enforce a peace agreement.
Do you think that this explains the Bush administration's willingness to ignore the majority of the Security Council members and go forward with the war on Iraq?
Well, it's really important to bear in mind that American unilateralism is hardly some sort of Bush invention. One doesn't even have to approve of it to say this. It's Clinton acted without UN approval three times. During his administration, and this was pointed out to me, for instance, when I was reporting on the UN this fall by Richard Holbrook, his own former UN ambassador. When we went into bombing Bosnia, we didn't get a Security Council approval. When we went into bombing Baghdad specifically, on several occasions under Clinton, we didn't. And most importantly, when the NATO action against Kosovo took place. And this is really the key precedent, I think, that we should bear in mind as we look at what's happening in Iraq right now. The Clinton administration went to the Security Council quietly, sniffed around. It didn't put forward a proposal. It basically went and asked the permanent members, what do you think? And Russia made very clear that it would absolutely veto any resolution to take military action against its Slavic brother, Serbia. At which point, instead of putting forward a proposal and having a big debate, the Clinton administration and its NATO allies said, fine, thank you. We know that we're not going to get the UN behind us. We'll go do this on our own. When they completed the military action, 77 days of intensive bombing, they immediately turned. And during that period, throughout the war in Kosovo, the military phase, you also had a strong diplomatic phase where America and its European allies were negotiating both with the UN and with one another about how they were going to deal with the aftermath. As soon as it was over, a movement was made at the Security Council to say, look, we want the United Nations to run the civil administration of this while NATO continues to preside over the military, police, and security apparatus. The Security Council passed a resolution authorizing a UN administration in Kosovo. In doing so, they essentially retroactively approved the military action.
How do you think the outcome of the debate on Iraq and the willingness of France to have cast a resolution, if it actually came to a vote, how do you think that's changed France's position as a world power, or France's position on the Security Council?
It's very difficult to say exactly how that's going to work over time. I think that France has probably injured itself in making a grand gesture. The word from Paris and the reports from Paris are saying that they are actually very grateful not to have been forced to cast a veto. They were not, and at the very last few days, it was really a question: would the Bush administration sort of force France's hand to cast the veto and be stuck with that stain on its record, or not? Now, you might wonder, why is it a stain to stand up for what you believe in? It's not, except that France took a position which was at least as non-negotiable as the United States' position. If it now appears clear that America went to the Security Council and said, basically, we're going to war in Iraq, and we would like you to sign on. Here's the dotted line. Sign or make yourselves irrelevant. The French said, we are not negotiating either. We think that there is no situation in which we could justify anything that allowed for the use of force. This is in direct contradiction of the resolutions that already passed, the French. So this is very wounding. It puts France in a kind of corner, and it makes France suddenly unable to claim that it was working for unity, that it was working for international consensus. It obviously took a divisive position. It also infuriated the Bush administration. It infuriated Tony Blair, who was clearly working much more fiercely than the administration to find a compromise position, and who expressed his frustration, I think, quite unambiguously and in not very diplomatic language in the House of Commons the other day. And I think those wounds, the diplomatic wounds, the damage that France did to the European Union, an organization in which America is not only not a member but really has no particularly grand influence, when Chirac exploded and scolded the Eastern European states who were supporting America and called them ill-behaved, badly brought up little countries that had missed an opportunity to shut up. This is an extraordinary explosion and deeply destructive. That damage is going to take France a good long time to get over.
In 1998, Kofi Annan said, vis-a-vis Saddam Hussein, he said, the UN is not in the business of taking out any president. Is what the U.S. was asking for, which is not just enforcing the weapons inspections, but regime change, is that considered outside of the job description of the United Nations?
Yes. The United Nations is a fundamentally conservative organization. And I think this is an important thing to keep in mind because one thinks of the UN as standing for all these progressive things, you know, greater world order, a little bit of compromise, shared sovereignty, you know, international justice, peace, all these fundamentally progressive causes. But it's actually in its bones a very deeply conservative organization, and conservative in the sense it is there to protect sovereignty. And the idea is you don't change. You don't meddle in the internal affairs of other states. This has always been an argument for non-intervention, even in the face of genocide. And in this case, I think the feeling is, look, Iraq is a member of the United Nations. The United Nations' job is to seek diplomatic solutions to tensions and problems. Its job is not to advocate regime change. That is nobody's policy anywhere. And, of course, when it was first being spoken of in 1998 and so on under the Clinton administration, regime change was the idea that the United States would support Iraqi oppositionists in changing their own regime. It's taken this new form of direct assassination more recently.
Kofi Annan met with Saddam Hussein in 1998 when Saddam Hussein started to block weapons inspectors from sites that they wanted to inspect. What kind of agreement did they reach, Saddam Hussein and Kofi Annan?
At that point, the inspections regime had been going on 7 years. It had a lot of success at the beginning. It had finally come to a standstill with the sort of games that one associates with Saddam Hussein. He was prohibiting the inspectors from visiting a number of massive facilities, which he claimed were presidential sites. This was not a category that had any meaning in the agreements that he had agreed to, but he suddenly said, you can't visit them, they're presidential sites. And there was this standoff, and the Clinton administration was threatening to bomb, and the French and the Russians, just as now, were saying, oh, let's let him go. And Kofi Annan went on a mission, and he played it up very big. He called it a sacred mission of diplomatic duty in the name of world peace, and he met with Saddam Hussein, and he basically made a deal where he said, look, you won't get bombed, and we won't push quite as hard with the inspections. And Saddam Hussein put on a lot of restraints and allowed the inspections to continue somewhat more delicately. And Kofi Annan came back and said, this is a man I can do business with, a line that's haunted him ever since, because, of course, Saddam Hussein had really given him the business. He had completely deceived him and pretty soon started breaking all the agreements. So for a moment, it looked like Kofi Annan had averted a war, and he was celebrated for that for about a month or two until the whole thing fell apart. Saddam Hussein then kicked out the inspectors. That's the famous 4 years ago that one heard about last fall. The Clinton administration bombed a little bit for 4 days, and that was when basically Iraq was sort of put on ice as an issue and left for the next guys, and that turned out to be President George Bush, whom we have now.
You wrote a book about the genocide in Rwanda. There are some people who have traditionally thought of themselves as anti-war, who find themselves supporting the war in Iraq in part because of what happened in Rwanda or Kosovo. Has that reporting on Rwanda shaped your opinion on America's war in Iraq now?
Frankly, I've always been ambivalent about the concept of humanitarian intervention. I support the desire behind it, which is to say, in the case of Rwanda, for instance, people always said, if the world had only taken action, all of these lives could have been saved. And I believe that's correct, that the world could have acted in a way that would have saved many, many lives. I also would always say, it's probably erroneous wishful thinking to assume that were the so-called international community or the great powers to act, they would act in a way that was both attractive, successful, and what one might have wanted. Because historically, it's the same people who get upset by interventions who also call for them. In other words, if you say, oh, let's act, you have to be able to accept the fact that they may not act the way you'll want them to, that ugly things can happen, that the aftermaths will not go the way you like, and that not all interventions are successful humanitarian interventions. And that, of course, what you are calling for is war. In the case of Iraq, I think a very strong humanitarian intervention argument could have been made. The problem is that it would have been better to have made it in the immediate aftermath of the Gulf War, when Saddam Hussein was actively involved in slaughtering his own people and committing great atrocities against the Shia and the Kurd populations. And when that was particularly striking because he had agreed to an armistice and a truce. So a case could have been made then. The difficulty at the moment for a humanitarian intervention argument is, of course, that there is no direct provocation. Saddam Hussein is one of the appalling tyrants of the past century, and he's a savage to his own people, but he's not in the course of a campaign against any particular population right now actively that we are going into halt. So, and the other thing is, the argument has not been made. This war is not really being billed as a humanitarian intervention. It's being billed as a regime decapitation, as they're using the phrase now, an attempt to basically take out a particular leader, and then as a liberation. It's also being billed as a war of disarmament. I feel that there are too many war aims to be able to be comfortable about it. But I think that the humanitarian argument for this war is actually strong. There's no question that Saddam Hussein is an enemy of all the things that not only the United States, but the United Nations and presumably the EU should stand for. And I think the problem is that the way that the diplomacy has been handled, the rhetoric that has been coming from Washington, the Bush administration does not inspire confidence in its capacity to manage the post-war scenarios it's talking about. To me, the relevant example here is Afghanistan. Looking at Afghanistan and the way that America has failed to follow through in the reconstruction and the post-war phase of Afghanistan, has obstructed a nationwide peacekeeping force, etc., leaves one to worry. Will we stay the course? Will we do what would be necessary to prevent Iraq from becoming a much bigger problem over time?
Philip Gurevich, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Philip Gurevich is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Earlier this month, he profiled Kofi Annan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Bondonato, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.